May it please the court, Barry Girk, arguing this afternoon for the plaintiffs below, the appellants, Kylie Burns, a minor, and her mother, Megan Burns. We are here after the grant of plaintiff's motion for re-argument, and this followed the court's opinion, written opinion, on June 10 of this year, which upheld the lower court's grant of summary judgment, resulting in a dismissal of the case below. There are a few factual discrepancies that I would like to address. One revolves around the injuries that the plaintiffs sustained. In the court's decision, it mentioned only the injuries to the minor plaintiff, Kylie Burns.
And that's significant. Why?
It's not significant in the sense it doesn't affect the legal principles, Your Honor, but I raised it to make sure the court was aware that we would not have taken the appeal, wasted the court's time, if we didn't have more substantial injuries.
You've raised substantial legal issues, and the fact that you've got a rare motion for re-argument granted should suggest to you that there are significant legal issues, and that factual, the failure to state that two parties are injured is really of no moment. What we're concerned about, or at least what I'm concerned about, are paragraphs 2, 3, and 4 of your motion. In particular, what facts bear on the common law rule of necessity and your position on whether that's an issue for the jury about which the court cannot rule based on the facts that were of record at the time of the grant of summary judgment.
I think that it is something that the issue is case dispositive on the appeal and would require a remand and a reversal to the court below. The Campbell case, which we cited and some other decisions in there, was not the first statement of this at common law. In fact, in the Campbell decision, the court said it's so well stated, it was in the elementary treatises citing Blackstone's commentaries, which came out in the 1760s. Then the court pointed out that it's part of the American jurisprudence as well, because it was referred to in the counterpart of Blackstone's commentaries, across the pond, so to speak, which is Kent's commentaries, which came out in the late 1820s. So this is not some arcane, small, little doctrine that came up in my research. This is a well-established, long-standing principle that is designed to eliminate a trespass because the person has to go around the obstruction blocking the public way.
So as I understand this doctrine, it's if a necessity is created. In this case, it would be the tree across the road. Then you can go on to private property basically as an invitee. And the fact in our case that some people chose to use another piece of private property should not be relevant to our situation. We should focus on the fact that the necessity was caused by the tree, and no matter whose private property you went on to, you basically were, you had the status of an invitee because of the necessity.
That's correct. The legal fiction is the person is a public invitee when they're on the public highway, and then when they are forced to go off the public highway onto the private property, without regard to the choice of evils, which side they go on, then the legal fiction is that they are continued in the status as a public invitee as long as it's a minimal intrusion and they go on the other side.
And well, in our case, the implication would be you're outside the guest premises statute.
Yes, Your Honor, because the established Delaware law, starting with Kane 31 years ago, that said that the premises guest statute doesn't apply to bar a personal injury claim where the status of the person injured is he or she is a public invitee.
Now, focus for a moment on the necessity. The tree blocked the road. Therefore, it's clear your client couldn't follow down the regular roadway to get where she was going. She had to do something.
Yes.
Does the concept of necessity mean she had to put herself in the position she put herself in? Could she, for example, have turned around in the roadway itself? It's a standard side road.
Well,
people can back up and maneuver a vehicle and just turn around the road, can't they?
If a standard size road has 12-foot lanes, it's not a standard size road. Camden is we might say, a quaint community.
I lived there for 30 years. I'm pretty familiar with Camden.
I'm certain you are, Your Honor. The road is less than that. I have a diagram in the facts. I'm recalling that it's 19 feet.
But in the concept of necessity, it sounds one argument you could make was the creation of the necessity is the fallen tree. anything goes after that. You can, if you have an option to turn around the roadway, you have an option to go on to someone else's property where there isn't anyone in the driveway, or you have the option of going on to someone's property where there is a vehicle in the driveway. Whichever one you take, it's caused by necessity. My question is, why would the facts compel us to reach that conclusion if the car or the vehicle, could have been maneuvered in such a way as to not have to leave the roadway and go on anyone's private property?
Well, according to the cases, the idea is not to impede a person's travel, and the cases actually link it into commerce, saying that this would impair commerce if you couldn't go on the adjacent property because you had to back up and go back and find another way that might get you to your destination.
Well, you're not suggesting that the facts here would show that your plaintiff or anyone else was driving straight ahead around the tree on the property.
No, that's how
were doing exactly what you were just talking about, backing up to go back and go another way.
That's true. But the cases and the doctrine coming from the common law talked about passing by the obstruction on the property.
But those aren't our facts.
No, they're not. The necessity is the blockage of the roadway, which establishes the legal fiction and permits the people to not become trespassers.
So even if you could turn around on the roadway itself without going on anyone else's property, but you choose because it's easier to turn into someone's driveway to back up and go back the way you came from, you're still the beneficiary of this common law rule of necessity that, in effect, negates the premises guest statute. That's your position.
I think there would be an argument to be made by the defendant that's what they could have done, as opposed to going into the driveway, stayed completely in the public street somehow, and maneuvered around. And that would go back to Your Honor's initial question. That might make it a question of fact, but it would have to be resolved by the jury, and it would not be a situation where the court could rule as a matter of law that these people were trespassers.
Who has the burden of proof with respect to demonstrating necessity?
I would say that the plaintiff has the burden of proof, Your Honor, because the burden of proof of establishing the affirmative defense would lie with the defense, and then it would be the plaintiffs who have to come forward and say, no, that doesn't apply because of this necessity.
Quoting from page 8 of the trial judge's opinion, the court has not been presented with facts concerning whether the Burns had any other possible ways to turn their vehicle around as opposed to using the defendant's driveway. Don't we have a situation where you're simply arguing that there's a factual vacuum from your side of the equation and that the record below doesn't support any argument that there really was necessity? What I'm really getting to is, what does the record below tell us about the fact that the Burns had to go on somebody else's land?
Well, we know that this was a Gladiator minivan, a very large minivan. We know that the particular street where this occurred is a narrow street, less than what might be deemed a normal street, and we know that the tree was blocking their passage.
A large minivan?
Well, they call it minivan style vehicle. It's a large conversion type van. Even if the vacuum of facts, as Your Honor refers, exists, this came up in the context that all the transcript we have is in the context of an arbitration hearing, where the legal issues weren't fleshed out. And if we were to invoke the rule of Ebersole versus Lowengrub, that under some circumstances there must be a remand where it's necessary to look at the facts very carefully in application with the law.
Who has your paragraph 4 suggests that the opinion was incorrect in its conclusion about who had the obligation to demonstrate and whether the facts didn't clearly demonstrate whether or not the plaintiff was on defendant's premises at the time of the collision?
Well, certainly that burden would fall on the defendant. And it's part of the defendant's case to show, under the premises guest statute, that the injury did, in fact, occur on the defendant's property.
It was certainly the thinking behind the first opinion that it was clear that where the collision itself occurred was undisputedly on the defendant's premises. Why is there still an issue about where the collision occurred?
Well, I think it's all inference is what that was based upon, Your Honor. There was no showing below where the boundary line actually was, such as by a survey. And the
would you need a survey to show that the collision occurred in someone's driveway to establish that the part of the driveway was part of the premises?
Well, but the driveway abutted up to the road, and we don't know how far the actual easement or right-of-way of the road extended.
Well, why does the easement or the right-of-way have anything to do with it? It's still the defendant's premises, even if the state has an easement or a right-of-way, isn't it?
Well, I think it might have an effect if we – because driveway is a generic term, and the people we're talking about where it happened in the driveway without reference to the legal niceties of the boundary line. Let's say there is a shoulder there, and the defendant's property ends before the shoulder, but it looks like the driveway goes over the shoulder, and both sides might characterize it as occurring in the driveway when, in fact, it's not
in
the driveway.
Well, as you stand there right now as an officer of the court, are you saying that you who wants to establish, because you have to, that a collision occurred at a certain spot, and the defense who wants to assert the premises guest statute, neither of you had facts that demonstrated exactly where the collision occurred?
I think it was clear from the testimony that neither party knew where the boundary line was. So I guess the answer would be yes. I believe that both parties stated in their testimony they did not know exactly where the boundary line was.
Let me go at it a different way. How many feet from where the road ended and the driveway began? How many feet into the driveway did the collision occur?
We don't have a measurement, Your Honor. I'm not trying to evade the court's question. The testimony on that is simply that she nosed her van into what appeared to her to be the driveway.
So it could have been 4 inches? Or you know, there's nothing about whether it was almost to the garage door or 4 to 6 inches into the property?
There is no testimony about the distance itself. There's also no testimony that she went as far up to the house or the garage that was there.
But as I understand your position, it's that you've alleged the collision occurred, and the defense is the statute, and whoever is asserting the defense has the burden of proof to show that the collision occurred on private property.
That's correct, Your Honor. Because it's their burden, any affirmative defense would be the same way.
Because we never get to the statute unless we have it established that the accident occurred on private property.
That's correct. And since we would never get to the statute, we would never get to this concept of common law, a way of necessity, and the whole public invitee status issue.
So your argument is twofold or in the alternative. One is that there's a material dispute of fact, or to the extent there's an assertion of a defense, it's not supported by the record because they haven't established that it was private property, so that's still a fact to be determined.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if the failure of the defense to establish that the accident or the injury occurred on the defendant's property is taken into account, then it becomes the facts are viewed in a light most favorable to the non-moving party, which be the plaintiffs, and the defendants would not have been entitled to summary judgment below because the judge would have ruled, based on this inference requirement, that the accident didn't happen on the private property.
Well, the trial judge heard from both sides about where the accident occurred and then granted summary judgment based on the premises guest statute, didn't he?
That's correct.
Well, how could there not have been facts to establish that the collision occurred on the defendant's premises, and the trial judge still grants summary judgment?
I think that what the trial judge assumed when the testimony supporting that was presented by both sides indicated that she nosed into the driveway, the assumption by the trial judge was that it was on the private property of the defendant.
Well, probably because the evidence was that she nosed into the defendant's driveway, correct?
Yes.
Which reasonable people would assume meant the defendant's premises.
Yes, but it was also established that she had no idea where the boundaries were. So if she were to say, I wasn't on her property, then she just doesn't know where the boundary line is.
Well, didn't your complaint allege that the accident occurred in the driveway?
I don't recall how we phrased it in the complaint, Your Honor. But if it did say that, then I don't think that should prevent the court from taking action today that would result in a remand for further exploration of the facts. I have just, in summary.
Oh, go ahead, yeah.
We're not asking the court to create a new doctrine. We're not asking the court to create a new exception to the premises guest statute. We're not asking the court to change any statutory law or change any court precedents. We're asking the court only to apply a long-settled, well-established doctrine as recognized as a recognized area of non-application of the premises guest statute. If the court reverses and remands in order to have the issue determined of whether the accident and the injuries occurred on the defendant's premises, such as by determining a boundary through a survey, a ruling on the public invitee status issue would prevent the parties from having to come back to the court if it were found that the accident and the injuries did occur on the defendant's property.
Do you know at this point, just to anticipate, If you turn out to be correct and it does result in a remand with an opportunity to develop the facts on this issue for the purpose of presenting the rule of necessity as a common law mechanism for overcoming the premises guest statute, and there is indeed a survey, and the survey shows that the line is dividing the right-of-way that the state occupies and the premises that's occupied by the defendant, is an X spot. You just told us nobody knows where the collision occurred anyway. So what difference does it make?
Well, I think if we have a survey, we would be able to see where the survey markers are and where the line is.
You'll see where the line is, but what does that tell you about where the collision occurred if nobody knows where it happened except in the driveway?
Well, I think that the plaintiffs would be able to go out there and say, well, the front of our car was here or here, and that would resolve it from the plaintiff's standpoint, and the defendant may say, oh, no, you were over that line, and then you end up with a question of fact for the jury.
Is it obvious to everyone but me that the police didn't investigate this?
The Camden, Wyoming, or the Camden police did investigate it, yes, they did.
As a part of their report, didn't they call it, identify a point of impact?
They may have said that it occurred on private property. I'm going from memory, but the same thing that I said about the plaintiff and the defendant would hold true. The officer doesn't know whether it's private property or not. It may appear that way to him, but the presence of the boundary line.
But did he, as Justice Berger suggested, as most police do for many, if not all, accidents, identify where the point of impact occurred from residue or whatever and note that in a diagram of the accident? Or was this such a minor accident in terms of impact on the vehicles anyway that he didn't go to the trouble of writing up a diagram of the accident?
Well, I know what the repair bill was for my client, so I can't say it was a minor accident, but I don't recall whether the police officer noted debris or broken glass that would usually be what they would identify as the point of impact. I can't say to the court one way.
Do you recall whether there was a diagram of the accident scene at all?
I don't recall that.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So just so we can understand the record, when this was being argued to the Superior Court, did you take the position unequivocally, you can't decide this case without a survey? Or were you arguing that something else? In other words, was it clear to the judge that you objected to deciding the case without a survey? Because during the course of the two arguments we've had, there's a real focus on the fact that there wasn't a survey to determine the property lines. And one gets the sense from reading the record that the complaint referred to a driveway, now the police referred to private property, the parties referred to a driveway. Everyone's working assumption was this was private property. Then the question was, did the statute apply or not apply because a motor vehicle was involved? But now, since the survey's front and center on this appeal, my question is, was the survey front and center in the Superior Court?
I can't say there was, Your Honor. I don't can't stand here in front of the court and say I argued that to the trial court below.
So Am I correct that the argument really assumed it was on private property, but notwithstanding the fact that it was on private property, your position should prevail? Isn't that what you argued to the Superior Court?
I think that was the assumption that everybody made based on the nosed into the driveway testimony. I see my yellow light is on.
Well, that means you have 4 minutes and 30 seconds left. You can save it or use it now. It's up to you.
Unless there's further questions from the court.
You want to save it?
I'll save it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Chief Justice, Justices, Vice Chancellor. Brian McNellis on behalf of Ms. Doan. She is the appellee below and the respondent here to the motion for re-argument. The justices have spent a bit of time asking questions about the facts here. In fact, there was a statement made just a moment ago that there was a vacuum of facts from below. Nature abhors a vacuum. There is more facts than have been presented here. There was just a question a moment ago as to what the investigating officer included in his report. There was absolutely a diagram in there. That diagram showed the vehicle in the driveway. No survey lines. There was not any measurements made, Justice, but there was a reference.
Is that in the someone's appendix?
Yes, it is. I think it's in the body of my motion on page 21 where it states, Operator 2, this would be Megan Burns, that's the plaintiff, entered onto the driveway of 226 Center Street to
no,
turn
around.
No,
I'm talking about a diagram that shows the car in the
driveway. Oh, I'm sorry. I think that's in one of the appendices, Your Honor.
The only police report I've seen that, from the record, shows a vehicle where the damage is on it and then has a narrative that discusses that the collision occurred at 226 something or other driveway. But I don't see anything that shows, I haven't seen anything that shows a car off the roadway onto somebody's driveway.
And maybe my recollection of the description rather than the diagram then, Your Honor, but I know the description.
Well, I just want to make sure I wasn't missing something.
And it may be that I had missed that. Maybe I'm recalling the description that he gave that stated in no uncertain terms, entered into the driveway. There was also testimony from all three of the people who were there, Megan Burns, the driver of the large minivan, her daughter in the back, and also from my client, that all state that the accident took place in the driveway. The investigating officer states it. The complaint states it. It is our position that we've met the burden of proof to establish that it is in the driveway for purposes of the statute. I would also
That's the rub, isn't it? You've established that it's in the driveway, but Mr. Girk comes back and says establishing that it's in the driveway doesn't necessarily mean it's on the premises, because what if, though apparently no one knew, including the Superior Court judge who granted summary judgment, that being in the driveway wasn't dispositive, that there's this imaginary line that divides the premises, theoretically, of the defendant from the state right-of-way. Is that, what's your position on that?
Well, I think that what Your Honor had pointed out a moment ago is the rub on that, and that is that the line isn't the disputed fact. It's the location of this large minivan. As to whether it's here or whether it's over here has already been testified to. And everyone who has addressed that issue states that this location is in the driveway. There is one description that was provided by my client, and
Before I get more confused, what I understand Mr. Girk to be arguing is that it's not case dispositive that the collision occurred in the driveway. And one of the reasons it isn't is because for the purposes of the rule of necessity, first, it doesn't matter whether it's on private property or not. But even before you reach the rule of necessity, he has an argument that says, wait a minute, the collision might have occurred in the state right-of-way or the town right-of-way. And therefore, it may not be a piece of property that the premises guest statute actually protects the occupier of the land from suit under these circumstances.
I don't think there's ever been a decision by the Delaware court that an easement or a right-of-way represents an exception to the premises guest statute. The issue has been addressed by the court on several occasions, including the Acton case, which decided that the mere presence of an easement, the possession of an easement, would indeed provide the protection of the statute. If the court provided the protection for the statute on the basis of only owning an easement, the presence of an easement, and again, an easement.
Well, it's the state that had. The defendant here is either a tenant of someone else or owns, in fee simple, a piece of property to which they may have given a right of way to the state. So the question becomes, is that portion of the driveway that might be in the state's right of way a piece of property to which the premises guest statute applies or not?
I would say that that decision has not been decided by the court. What I would point out that on several occasions the court has addressed in the past the applicability of the premises guest statute to provide that protection to the owner of only an easement. And if the court has provided that protection to the possessor of merely an easement, the idea that that protection to the possessor of the property, and in this instance my clients leased the property, that that protection wouldn't apply to the actual possessor because that easement would have existed. It's not been decided, but I would say as a logical follow through on that conclusion, there would be no exclusion. Plus, the statute itself sets forth some very specific exclusions. If you're a business invitee, if you're there for trespass, if you're, the legislature had an opportunity to include.
Mr. Ramirez, I'm confused now. Let's drop back a couple of steps. If the accident took place on the defendant's private property, then the guest statute applies, correct?
Yes,
sir. I mean, putting aside any issue of necessity. If the accident took place in that portion of the driveway on which there was still a public easement, make that assumption, does the statute apply or not?
I would argue that it would.
It would.
Your Honor is describing those as mutually exclusive, as if there was a line. There's two lines, essentially, and our position is there is only one. There is the edge of my client's property. There is not another line, kind of a line.
Well, let's just assume, let's get through the factual clutter and assume, as I asked you to do, that the accident took place on that portion of the driveway that was subject to the easement. Your argument is that the statute still applies.
I would say, Your Honor, that it does apply. There has not been any case law.
All right. What would be the rationale for that? Because that there still would be. I mean, is it that there would not, that portion of the driveway would not be private property, or it is private property, but the fact that it's burdened by an easement somehow creates an implied exception to the statute? What's the argument?
The argument that it would apply or would not apply. The argument that it would not apply would, I imagine, be that the easement's there for some purpose and would remove it from the protection. That's never been decided by the court.
Right.
And as I mentioned a moment ago, there has been Delaware Supreme Court case law that provides premises guest statute protection to the possessor of merely an easement on a piece of property.
But the possessor of the mere easement on this property is the public, at least by hypothesis.
That's
so
correct.
So I'm asking you to address that question.
Well, I would say that it would be probably an aberration of the law to give that protection to the holder of the mere easement, but not to the actual possessor of the property who can put up a mailbox and has to mow it and relies upon that statutory protection to say, I'm not going to be sued for mere negligence by something that happens.
Mr. McNellis, am I correct? We don't even know at this point whether there's an easement of any kind or not?
Exactly right, Your Honor. What we have is an affidavit.
And if there is an easement, just from looking at the property, is it not fair to say that it's not a public easement in the sense of a right-of-way? It's an easement given for a particular purpose, either to put up utility lines or as a part of the state-maintained or town-maintained roadway. I think it's the state-maintained roadway for whatever period of feet they want off the main travel portion of the roadway. But under no circumstances is it possible for there to be an easement as a part of this driveway for the purpose of public travel, is there?
No, Your Honor, and you've articulated better than I could possibly. And that is that easement, even if it did exist, and I don't think we have factual evidence at this point, we have an affidavit that's fuzzy on the issue and talks about generalities.
Well, but we don't have to be ignorant. I mean, there either are telephone lines, there are Comcast cable lines, there are often an interloper on others' actual easement, by the way, Comcast. But there's some purpose for the easement, but it is not, under any circumstances, an extension of the traveled portion of the roadway for the public, is it?
It is not, Your Honor. I also wanted to clear up one other.
Well, before we use all of the time on the first point, what's your response to Mr. Girk's argument that if this occurred on private property, based on the Campbell case, that the statute doesn't apply because the necessity changed the status of the plaintiff to an invitee?
That is a factual issue that I want to make sure that the court is clear on. There has been a lot of talk here about necessity of pulling onto that driveway to turn around. It is undisputed, and if I didn't, it's my failing if that was not made clear to Your Honors before in our earlier argument. Miss Burns did not pull into the driveway to turn around, not for convenience, not for necessity, not to turn around. She pulled into the driveway to consider her options as to what she should do. That isn't simply McNellis arguing. This is her undisputed testimony. At the time she testified, she was asked by Mr. Girk, what did you do after you pulled in? Her answer: I looked for somewhere where I'd be able to turn around, and I saw there was a vacant lot behind. So I put my car in reverse. I stopped. I was looking over my shoulder to make sure that nothing was coming either way, and to make sure I could navigate into that back lot. Now, we've heard a 150-year-old Connecticut case cited, but there is no case law cited that states necessity is to step onto somebody's property to contemplate the options of how to get around an obstruction. She wasn't pulling into the driveway to turn around. Her intention was to look in a rearview mirror, assess that there was a place to turn around that everybody else was using across the street, and then to employ that. This was a staging area to contemplate her options, not a mechanism to turn around, necessity, convenience completely aside.
Let's assume that the facts are construed slightly differently and that the process of pulling into the driveway for the purpose of ultimately finding a way to turn around is close enough to the idea that you were using this property because the tree was in the way and because you were now in the process of turning around. Assuming that, does Campbell provide an exception to the applicability of the premises guest statute?
I don't believe it does, and that is the argument that Justice Steele had presented just a moment ago. It is the plaintiff's burden, the appellant's burden, to show that necessity existed. And there simply isn't that showing at this point.
That under Campbell, the tree is the undisputed necessity.
The necessity being, I have to use the driveway in order to circumvent that obstruction. Tree is the obstruction. The necessity arises from, I'm obligated to use this path, this avenue of redress to get around that obstruction, hasn't been shown.
Wait a second. I must have misunderstood the case law here, but I thought the idea was once the necessity is established, then all of the adjoining property becomes property that you are permitted to use to deal with that necessity. So it's not that you have to then prove, well, I could have gone this way, I could have gone that way, and which one was better. But just that there was a tree blocking the road, therefore I had to turn around and go back. Therefore, I was free to use a driveway on one side of the street, a vacant lot on the other side of the street, whatever. I was an invitee for purposes of getting by that tree.
I think, Your Honor, there would still be an obligation to prove the fundamental existence of the necessity. And that would include that you couldn't turn the van around within the confines of the roadway, not using anybody's property whatsoever. That would be a dangerous following of logic. We can certainly envision someone who's several hundred yards down the street who observes the tree and Sal wants to use those driveways and create a necessity back there and now wants his protection to be able to sue the homeowner for mere negligence.
Justice Berger's hit on the very point that, at least in part, caused us to grant the motion for re-argument, developing this
rule of necessity as it applies to these facts. And that was my question to Mr. Girk, which he's just repeated to you. And it's still, I think, the gravamen of that issue, if not the case. What constitutes necessity? As she points out in her question, the tree blocking the main travel portion of the roadway creates a need to do something to get where you're going. Does it mean anything goes because the necessity is to act because the road is blocked? Or does the rule of necessity mean you only do what is necessary and reasonable in order to avoid the block in the road? What does the law say in that respect?
Well, Your Honor, we are mining a 150-year-old Connecticut case to address that. But I would certainly argue from a logic standpoint that it does not give any party who now faces down what could be arguably a necessity carte blanche to do whatever they please.
Can this case be resolved without dealing with this issue? If so, how?
Well, I think the case could be resolved without the issue of necessity because in this instance, necessity doesn't even exist. Plaintiff wasn't using the driveway to turn. She was using it to contemplate her options, and that is not a necessity by any definition.
That's your argument, and Justice Berger pointed out to you that there's another way to look at those same facts. So she's not wrong when she suggests there's another way to consider those facts.
There's certainly not. There's absolutely another way to look at it. I think that precedent could be rather difficult down the road, and perhaps Mr. Girk points it out better than I could in one of the first pages of his notes in his motion for re-argument. He states on the first page when he's actually talking about damages. He says, of course, the nature and extent of the injuries are immaterial to the application of the legal principles because defendant could have just as easily backed over and killed a small child who had ventured onto her driveway to avoid the fallen tree. The inference of that statement is that a child now walking on the sidewalk who ventured into the driveway to avoid this tree would have the protection of necessity creation, that his discretion as to how to get around a sidewalk would remove statutory protection from the homeowner against a mere negligence allegation. I think that's what this would ultimately lead to, giving that level of discretion, saying to a person who faces a necessity in front, an obstruction that he can't get around, you now have carte blanche to do whatever you think you need to on an adjacent piece of property, that person wouldn't have protection.
How do we limit that doctrine? Let's assume there's a necessity because there's a tree down, and I can turn into the driveway on the right, the driveway on the left, the driveway on the right. Does it mean no matter which driveway I go into, I'm a trespasser for purposes of the premises guest statute? Equally reasonable choices. It seems to me that one can argue that either choice is reasonable, therefore one's not a trespasser, or perhaps more specifically one's a privileged trespasser when one turns into either driveway. And you're suggesting that there's no driveway because there are choices that the person can turn into and not be a trespasser.
Well, I would certainly argue that will be question two. The first question would be, can you avoid the obstruction without being a trespasser or potentially an invitee on anybody's property, and that has not been established at this point.
So in other words, you're saying because the record is not clear that the three-point turn wouldn't have worked, you win. Is that really your position here?
What I am pointing out to the court is that burden to show necessity, that a three-point turn would not work, would have to be shown before necessity could be triggered, and then would go down the path of, gee, is that a necessity or is over here a necessity? We haven't got there yet because there has not been a showing that it could have been avoided without intruding upon anybody's property. And without that, we don't have that triggering of necessity under an examination of old Connecticut law or under a new ruling from the court. Saying that we have necessity when we haven't established that it can be avoided without intruding upon anybody's property, I think that they have not met their burden, and that's why we should be. Again, that assumes that the court were to find that necessity existed in this instance at all, and it's our position that that is not the case. Oh, thank you, Your Honor.
Just briefly, I'd like to address the question that was raised by the court about the right-of-way, and I'm thinking about the Malin case of Consolidated Rail, where it was a private property, but it looked like a road, and the person was going over this railroad crossing and sustained injuries, and the defense raised the premises guest statute as an affirmative defense, and this court said that because it appeared to be a right-of-way, a continuation of the public way to the landfill, I think is where the person was heading, that this person enjoyed public invitee status. And because he was a public invitee on what appeared to be a public right-of-way, public way, then the premises guest statute did not apply to that situation. And if we were to extend that to the factual situation of the street in front of this defendant's house, the street, part of the street is paved, and there is obviously some kind of a street right-of-way. We introduced evidence below through our expert that the right-of-way likely extended beyond the paved portion of the street. There is a gravel section and then the lawn. And so it is quite possible that my client, in thinking that she nosed into the driveway, thinking she was on private property, may not have gone outside of that right-of-way reserved for the street, even though she went off the paved portion.
But your client, according to her testimony, thought she was going on the private property, correct?
Yes, I think
there was nothing about what she saw that suggested to her that it was public, like the Malin case.
Well, that's true, but she could be
in what... That's a big truth, isn't it?
She could be, think she's in the driveway and think she's on private property, still be within that street right-of-way. And where I was headed with this is then Malin would come into play.
Yeah, well, the police officer identified it as a private driveway, didn't he?
Well, he did, but we've discussed the fact that he didn't know where the boundary was either.
But that says a lot about what it appeared to be, as the Malin case discusses, doesn't it? If it appeared to the police officer to be a private driveway, wouldn't that take Malin out of the equation?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because, again, we're talking about what the actual state of the facts are and whether the defendant has satisfied the burden of showing that she's entitled to the protection of the statute because it happened on her property.
Okay.
I'd like to address now just briefly the idea that the tree is the necessity. The court has asked questions about this of both counsel, and I want to emphasize that the blockage of the roadway is the necessity that is the foundation for the doctrine to be applied, and it's not a question of does the injured party who goes around the blockage or avoid the blockage, not whether they're on Blackacre or Whiteacre.
Mr. Kirky, just clarify one predicate point here. The necessity argument presupposes that if the doctrine of necessity applies, that is, if the facts support the application of that doctrine, then that automatically negates the application of the guest statute. Is there a case in this jurisdiction that holds that as a legal matter, that premise?
There's not a case that holds that as a legal proposition directly, but there is a step in between. If the doctrine holds that these people who avoid the blockage are public invitees, the missing link is Delaware recognizes that public invitees don't have the bar of the premises guest statute.
Well, the real question here is, suppose you're right that the doctrine of necessity applies. What follows from that legally? What usually follows from the doctrine of necessity is that renders the party who of necessity has to trespass not a trespasser as a legal matter. What that normally means, putting aside the guest statute, is that that person couldn't be sued. The plaintiff here could not be sued by the property owner for trespassing. Or if the property owner, I'm sorry, the plaintiff, well, let me stop there. There's no linkage between not being a trespasser for common law property purposes and the premises guest statute, unless there's a case that creates that linkage.
I don't have a case, Your Honor, but I view it somewhat differently because it is a determination of the status of the travelers who are blocked, whose passage is blocked, as opposed to a bar to a suit. They're determined to be not trespassers, but in fact public invitees. And then the plaintiffs take it one step further with the line of authority from this court that says public invitees are protected from the bar of the premises guest statute.
Just to make sure, I know we're out of time, but just to make sure I understand your position, and your concept of necessity and the way it should work in under the common law, the way it does work, is that it's not simply the fallen tree forces a person who would not otherwise trespass to trespass in order to make their way around the obstacle. Anything they do that will get them around the obstacle is okay and takes them out of the class of trespasser for the purposes of the premises guest statute. In other words, there could be an alternative that doesn't require that they go on private property. There could be an alternative that they go on private property where it's safer than the one option they did take. But your position is none of that makes any difference. It's not a requirement that they take the safest alternative.
That's correct. The
tree
is a necessity.
Sure I understood that.
And I think that the standard the court could apply for the future, the guiding principle would be what was reasonable under the circumstances, or maybe more correctly, what wasn't unreasonable under the circumstances, because you don't – the point that I'm trying to make is that it's not going on Greenacre versus Blackacre that's the focus of the court.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.